Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Movie Mentors. I'm your host, Jeremy Boros, and today I'm excited to talk with Frank Caracci. For the last 20 years, Frank has directed some of our most beloved comedy classics. His collaborations with Adam Sandler and Kevin James have brought us such films as The Waterboy, The Wedding Singer, Click, Zookeeper, Here Comes the Boom, Around the World in 80 Days, The Ridiculous Six, and more. Frank's unique knack for generating side-splitting laughs and heart-wrenching drama has allowed many of his films to achieve massive box office success and a loyal fan base around the world. His second feature, The Wedding Singer, has consistently made the top 10 list of best romantic comedies, and if you grew up in the early 2000s like me, chances are you can quote more than a few lines from The Waterboy. In addition to being a brilliant filmmaker, Frank's also an incredibly kind human being and a great conversation. So I'm thrilled to share our chat with you. Here's Frank Caracci. Thank you so much for doing this, Frank.
You got it.
Great to see you. You look awesome. Thanks for inviting me to your home.
You're welcome. It's nice to have you.
Yeah. And you've been traveling the whole world, basically, for your next project, right?
Well, I wish not the whole world, but a lot of Europe. Yeah. I was in London quite a bit, Portugal, Bulgaria, where else? I get around. While I'm over there, I always pop a few other places, Berlin. I like to catch up with some old friends, too.
Yeah. So can you tell us about your next project?
Yes, it's a project I'm extremely excited about. It's The Legend of Sinbad. So nice. It's one of the stories from 1001 Arabian Nights.
Yeah.
And it was like, I think I kind of manifested it because I was doing an indie with Steve Coogan, which we could talk about later if you want. But I was it was fun to do a low-budget indie. It was $3 million budget. But when you do an indie like that, you kind of just find locations. You don't get to, like, paint walls and do all kinds of set changes. And I was home one night, and Around the World in 80 Days was on TV, another movie that I had directed with Steve Coogan. And I'm watching, going, oh, my God, every single detail of that movie, doorknobs, inventions, light bulbs. I'm like, we designed every single part of it. And I was like, man, this is awesome to do an indie, but I kind of miss doing that kind of thing. And when I was done with this movie, the script came across my desk for The Legend of Sinbad. And I thought, wow, this is an amazing canvas to create imagination and you know, paint and create a whole new world. So I kind of got my wish, and I'm kind of in the pre-production stages right now, and super excited because it's really imaginative, and it's like it's gonna be a fun spiritual movie. I think it's a good time for this story
spiritual.
To be told.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Is it gonna be sort of a family comedy like Around the World in 80 Days?
Yeah, or? It's probably gonna skew a little bit older. Uh-huh. But it'll kind of cover the four quads, as they say in the biz. But it's for kind of everybody. It's PG-13. It'll skew a little bit more mature. The cool thing about it is, in this day and age, I feel like the movies that people go to the theaters for mostly are like Marvel type movies.
Right.
And it's funny, Marvel kind of ran out of all their first string characters. And this has a lot of the fun action and adventure and imagination of a Marvel movie. But what I'm trying to bring to it, there's real loss. Sinbad's dad dies in the beginning. Mm. There's some really painful moments, and there's some real comedy moments. I particularly like movies that, in a way, they reflect life. Life is filled with some really heavy-duty moments, and it's filled with some really light and fun moments. So I love movies that can not be afraid to get dark, make you laugh along the way, and end with sort of an uplifting kind of message. And I feel like I can do that pretty well with this movie.
That's exciting. But let's start at the beginning. So where are you from? And when did film sort of make its way into your life and how?
Okay, so I'm from Long Island, New York. I'm from a very small little blue-collar town named Shirley, Long Island. I always feel like Long Island's an interesting breeding ground for some bizarre people.
Yeah, I think all islands, whatever, you know, definitely get some interesting folks.
Since I was a kid, I just loved movies. I remember when I was 7... my parents brought me to see a play. I can't remember what it was. But the thing I remember the most is walking down 42nd Street. And I was just like, oh, my God, this is like another planet. It was just like smoke coming out of the ground. There was a guy with an afro with a boombox. We're going to the 70s now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there was just energy and life. And I was just like, as a 7-year-old, I clocked, like, I got to get back here. And being from my small town. So when I got to the point of going to college, I was never exposed to many arts just growing up. I'm from a very business background family. Dad was in real estate and that kind of thing. And my sister, who has always been a good influence, she's like, just go to New York and go for business. I'm like, all right, as long as I go to New York, I'm going to be cool. I get out of the cab at NYU and I see people with cameras making movies. And I was like, wow, that's a job? I was like, I didn't know that was one of the options. So right away, just getting my ass to New York City exposed me to things. And immediately after my first semester, I took a film class. It was called Film Now. And I had this amazing professor, Nick Tanis. It was a Thursday night class where it'd be like 400 lecture kind of class. They would show a movie and then we would talk about it. And all week we'd see short films from that director. And this night was Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life. I'm, 18 years old. I had never seen the movie. I was up 17, maybe. I see the movie, and Frank Capra is one of my favorite directors now. I didn't realize it then. Movie touched me. I literally got teary-eyed and thought, what an amazing story. Blew me away.
Yeah.
Thursday night, this night, all the kids go out of school and go get drunk because nobody goes to school on Friday in college in NYU. So the teacher says, well, you guys can all leave, but whoever, anyone wants to stay, I'm going to go to the movie with a flashlight, and I'm going to tell you why the director made certain decisions. And I just was like, a director made decisions? Like, I feel this way because a human being made all these choices. And so about 20, 25 kids out of the 400 kids stayed. The teacher went through it. Nick Tanis went through it and explained framings and just talked through choices that he knew, some background he knew. And I just was blown away. I could not even conceive of how it could happen. And I just literally from that point on, I had the bug. I was like, I need to fully understand this. I need to be able to do this. I have to understand how to do this because I can't believe that a person can have so much influence on another person. And I was just hooked.
So what you're saying is you transferred into film after your first semester.
I took a film class and then I had to sit my dad down and said, Dad, I took a bunch of classes the second semester. And I said, Dad, I'm going to switch to film. And I said, I'll minor in business since he was paying for my school. So I had to double up on classes and I had to double up in the summers. And the funny thing was my dad, who was, he remembered the movie The Godfather. And if you remember the scene with the horse's head in the bed,
my dad,
the first thing he said is, you don't want to go into be a director because the mafia is going to own you. And I was like, no, Dad, they just have the Teamsters. It's okay.
That's hilarious.
No, it was a true story, though. He really said that.
Oh my God.
And I said, no, don't worry. It's not like that. And it's funny, he was kind of disappointed because I was the only son. He took over his dad's business. But at some point when I was graduated, I shot a PSA for Rock the Vote. And I'm in Washington Square Park and everybody's working for free. My dad bankrolled it. It was a couple $1,000, the Rock the Vote PSA. Mm. But I had a crew of 50 people. It's Washington Square Park. We had dolly track going across the middle, like silencing the crowd. He saw me in my element. And from that day on, he was just like, okay, this kid's doing the right thing.
Yeah. And now, if I'm saying this correctly, doesn't he have his entire living room is your movie posters?
In their house in Florida, they literally have all my movie posters across the wall. And it's funny because since a lot of them are Adam Sandler movies, guests that come over are like, are you just obsessed with Adam Sandler? And then they're like, no, it's our son did a bunch of the movies.
Yeah. So he's proud.
Both him and my mom are very proud. And obviously once I did the movies that people saw, once I did The Wedding Singer, the hook was already, it was already sunk, but it was really sunk after that. And it's funny even when we go out to restaurants, they're always like, our son's a director. Give us a better table. I'm like, hey, back off.
Well,
those pushy Italians from New York.
Yeah, right. So you transferred into Tisch. Was there a specific class or professor other than the one you just mentioned that really influenced you, gave you maybe words of wisdom that you've taken through your career?
There was a number of teachers, professors, and I got to say, a lot of friends. I had, I was a little behind everybody because they were already taking film. They were almost a year ahead of me by the time I fully switched. My network of friends that I'm still friends with, they were like making movies in high school. And so I would work on their movies and I would learn so much. And, the greatest thing at NYU, they kind of make you do everything. So I was pulling focus as an AC. I was doing this. But I had this personality where I would always say on my friends' films, hey, you know what you can do? to the point that was like the catchphrase for me.
Frank's you're that
like,
guy.
You know what you can do. Yeah, and that's when you realize you have to be a director because it's the control freak in you. But yeah, teachers, I had some, Nick Tanis was one of the best. There was an amazing writing teacher, and he had this whole idea of like, when you're watching a movie, why are you watching now? And it's one of these things I still keep in my head. It's like, why? And when it's more in the screenwriting phase, but then when you're editing, it's like, why am I watching now? And he also taught me things like, you know, you show the knife that's in the drawer that later when you're in the room, when you're getting attacked, you go, the knife's in the drawer. I wish I could remember his name, but if we can think of it after, I'll give it to you. But he was a great, a lot of it's, you know, it's storytelling is a big part of learning. Boris Fruman. It's funny. I had a teacher, he was a Russian teacher, and he tried to teach everyone art in a black and white way. He would put a photo up and he would say, Frank, what is right about this picture? And at first I'm like, you can't just say what's right. It could be a lot of things. It's art. And he's like, no, what is right? And then you go, well, the lens choice, the long lens. He's like, right. And it's funny. It's not the way you think about art, but because he made me do that every day, I started to really understand what mattered. So mm-hmm. I think it was more of a method of teaching than a way to look at art, but it did teach me. So it was a really good, a bunch of intelligent people that I had teaching me. And and it's funny things like my first movie was in a film festival and
Murdered Innocence?
Murdered Innocence was the first, a little indie I did for like $200,000. And I remember Boris Fruman's film was in the film festival too. I was like, wow, I'm in a film festival with my professor.
By the time you graduated, had you made a bunch of shorts, you know, in and out of school?
In school, I made a bunch of shorts. And then it's funny, I freaked out when I graduated because you got to be a director, right? And then you graduate and now you have an iPhone that you can shoot a movie on. It's high definition. You can edit a movie on your iPhone or your laptop. Then you were just thrown into the world and you didn't have this ability to make movies anymore. So I actually applied to every grad school. I almost got into AFI. They reject. I used to have my rejection letters. NYU rejected me, which it would have been the same program twice, so it wouldn't have been the best thing. But I just wanted to make movies. So the first thing you do is you try to get a job where you can get film equipment. So I was a PA just because I wanted to work in the biz and learn as much as I could. But I was literally, you know, driving a truck, carrying C stands around for cough commercials. But then I got a job at Chiat Day Advertising Agency because I used to make the reels for them. And then I would edit like they would call Rip-O-Matics. And I just had editing equipment. And so then we'd use the cameras and we'd go out and shoot stuff on the weekend. So I kept just shooting shorts. I'm like, if I'm a director, I got to keep directing. That's what I tell kids now. They're like, what should I do? I'm like, take your phone, write a story, get your friends together, edit it. And I'm like, finish it. Because when you finish it, that's when all the mistakes you made, you have to pay the price of finishing it. And that's where the learning curve is like super, super steep right at the end. That's where you learn everything.
Yeah, well, that was going to be another major question because God knows how many people are about to graduate or have already graduated. And what do you do?
Try to work in your field, in any field, like whatever your art is, try to work in that field in the most creative way. And don't worry about money. Like, I remember my parents were like, you're making $90,000 a year at this advertising agency. And I'm like, I'm not in it for the money. I'm there because I can use the editing equipment. That's all that matters to me. And I'm actually learning some filmmaking skills and just seeing, you know, I wasn't really interested in making commercials, but it was just about having that equipment. And so the closer you could be to being creative in your field, the better. Soon after that, I got a job directing travel documentaries. The opportunity came up and I just jumped at the chance. I always believed in travel as really important.
So you did that for 4 years after you graduated?
Yeah, more or less.
And then how did Murdered Innocence come about?
The funny thing about that is I actually...
Which was your first feature?
My first feature was Murdered Innocence. Okay, so it's a funny story. On Long Island, I lived in Manhattan. I'm on Long Island with my girlfriend at the time, and we're in a video store when there were video stores. And she was an attractive girl. And I turn around the corner and there's a guy basically hitting on her saying, yeah, I'm a movie maker to my girlfriend. And he's saying like, I'm an actor and a director and a producer. And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm a movie maker too. I direct too. He goes, oh yeah, you got a reel? And I go, yeah, I got a reel. And at that time I had done a short with Sandler. By the way, we were friends from school. We can get into that.
Yeah.
I had the PSA. I had a bunch of little short films I did. So I gave it to him and, he was this independent filmmaker on Long Island that made a bunch of very, very kind of B, kind of schlocky movies. But they played on Showtime, which was a big deal, you know, relative to everything. And so he liked my reel and he said, "You want to direct a movie?" And I'm like, "Well, send me the script." So I read this script and it's this very chatty cop script that's kind of not that well written. And I'm like, "Oh my God, this is my first chance to maybe do a movie." And he goes, "We have 14 days to shoot it. I'm the lead." The guy had to be the lead. I read it and I called up one of my buddies from NYU, Steve Peros, who was a pretty good writer and a good filmmaker. And I said, "Shit, this isn't exactly the perfect first movie." And I'm thinking, like, "You think we could rewrite it?" And he's like, "Yeah, let's rewrite it." Yeah. I like, "We had 2 weeks to rewrite it." So we had 2 weeks to rewrite it. And we go, "Let's make it a film noir because we love film noir." It had a bunch of flashbacks to the 70s. It was a murder kind of dark story with a guy with a lot of history coming out of jail, a lot of dark history. And so we rewrote it in 2 weeks. And I shot this little movie for $200,000 on Long Island. It was it's a cool little movie. It ended up getting picked up by Columbia TriStar Home Video. That's when it was like a big deal to be, home video. It was a VHS when you think back then. So it was kind of like, wow, I made a movie. I was super excited. And I guess I was about 25 at the time. I actually still had the travel job. I somehow managed to talk them into sending one of my friends on one of the trips to South America while I made the movie.
Wow. I love that. That's just amazing. Just the synchronicity of like that guy trying to take your girl and winds up giving you a job and launches, you know, a certain element of your career. It's hilarious. Going back, of course, NYU is known for its amazing education, but also your peers and future collaborators that are in the classroom with you. So let's talk about that first meeting. Do you remember meeting Adam Sandler, the circumstances?
Yeah, so it was the end of the first year, I believe, my freshman year. And my roommate, Jack Araputo, who went on to produce a bunch of Adam's movies, was like, "Hey, that guy Adam Sandler wants to hang out with us." And I always knew Adam from, he would do stand-up at we had a thing called the Coffee House. Mm-hmm. And it was just a stand-up show, and he was very funny.
He was in drama?
He was in drama. Okay. I was in film school. Jack was in business school.
Was Tim Hurley?
He was Adam's roommate, and he was in business school.
Oh, wow.
This was like the Wall Street era. This is like before when the movie Wall Street came out. Uh-huh. So everyone wanted to be like, you know, the business students all wanted to be like Wall Street guys, wheeling and dealing, making tons of money like that. And the irony is that when the year, right when we graduated, the market crashed and everybody switched careers. That was going to be a Wall Street trader. Wow. But yeah, he said, "Let's go hang out with Adam." I go, "Oh, that guy seems pretty funny." Yeah. We went out like to whatever, out in New York, went out to a bar, whatever. We got drunk like you do in college. And I remember we came back to our dorms and we had these crazy dorms where we had five people in one room, but we had giant walk-in closets. It was an old hotel. So what would you do when you got back?
Was it Ruben or Hayden?
It was actually Brittany.
Brittany. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what we would do is when you got back and all your roommates were sleeping, you'd actually hang out in the closet. And so we all hung out in the closet and we just made each other laugh. We got stoned, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And we just fucking made each other laugh. Like, I remember my high school friends, we used to do crazy voices. And one of my best friends, Sam, he's a chef, Sam DeMarco. And I'm like, man, I thought I'm going to college. Those days are over. And then I go freshman year and I meet this other group of guys. And I'm like, oh, I still get to make silly voices and do all this silly stuff. We just hit it off, me, Jack, my roommate, and Adam and Tim. And from that point on, we're like, every year we're going to live across the hall from each other. And we just would constantly write comedy songs. We'd hang out and just make each other laugh. We had video cameras, were just new then. My sister had one and I borrowed it and I never gave it back. And we would do prank phone calls. We would just like do characters for each other. And like some of the characters we did, like the water boy was this character that we would be like the weird guy in the shopping and that would push the shop, collect the shopping carts. That was a little bit not all there.
Wow.
And we used to do that character and he evolved into the water boy. We made him a much nicer, likable character.
Right.
Yeah, so it was a great like kind of playground to come up with these crazy ideas and it all worked. We were like, we're gonna make movies someday, and you know, we found ourselves on the set 8 years later, I think, from when we graduated, where we were actually doing a movie together.
It sounds like the connection was super instant. And were you guys already kind of finding your roles of like, you're the director, Adam's the actor, Tim's the writer?
Yeah, we kind of knew what we were doing. They, like I said, they were, Tim was always writing stand-up for Adam. He just had this knack for it, you know? I mean, he just taught himself. And Adam's doing, by senior year, Adam's doing stand-up 6 nights a week. He was a workaholic from then. He was like, I'm going to be the funniest man on the planet. and he did it. And Jack was always around, just supportive. And the coming up with the humor, though, Jack was a part of it for sure. He wasn't a writer necessarily. And then, as we graduated, like I said, the market crashed. But I had this idea to do an 80s movie. I was just like, 80s is such a thing. And this is 96.
Okay.
And that was only 6 years earlier, was the 80s, right? And Adam had an idea, or Tim had the idea of a wedding singer who gets jilted on the stage. And we're like, why don't we, I was like, why don't we make it 80s? Because that way, if you're singing songs, it won't look like you're trying to be cool. It'll be a little more kitsch if we go to 80s. And so we pitched that to New Line instead, and they loved the idea. That movie, we had no idea it was going to be a hit. We made it for like no money, and it obviously blew up. And at that point, I thought, wow, I can reach like 100 million people now. Like, do I want to make little weird movies? I'm like, maybe I'll get to that. I'm like, let me ride this wave of reaching a lot of people, and got to make the movies that I wanted with Adam, because they kind of left us alone to do what we wanted.
So really?
It was, in a way, as an artist, it was a really privilege.
I don't know if they'd take that kind of a risk anymore, would they? I mean, the budgets were really low.
The budgets on the Wedding Singer was like
18 million or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
But still, for someone who's made one feature for 200,000, that's a pretty big difference. Were you nervous or?
I was not. So I was on the set. I don't want to say what movie, but I was on the set of a movie. All right, so I came out to LA, and while I was doing all that other stuff, doing the videos, I was on a set of another movie. And I watched, the director was making one movie. He was quoting Kurosawa, who I love. The producer was quoting another movie. The actor was quoting another movie. I'm like, this is just going to be a train wreck because everybody's making a different movie. And I saw that and I thought, I know how to like get everybody together. It's like, I know how to unify people. And I just got really confident that like, I think I could do this probably pretty well. Once you make one, the first feature is the most hardest thing because you can't imagine comprehending, holding a whole feature in your head. And then once you do it, you're like, oh, it happens. Yeah. It's this live thing that you make and it happens. It's like,
right.
Like making a concert. So I had the confidence to do it. But the funny thing was, I remember when I made my movie, I had like one grip truck and whatever. The crew was really small. I remember getting out on Sunset. We were shooting our first day. I'm in like a little Honda Civic rental. And we're shooting in the little house. It's a scene in the Wedding Singer where he's making it with the grandma, where he's teaching with the piano.
I love her. Yeah.
Yeah. And so all it is a scene in the house, right?
Yeah.
And I get out of my car where they told me to park, and there's truck after truck after truck after truck. Like, you couldn't imagine that this little scene had all this film equipment.
Right.
And that was the only time I got nervous. I'm like, why do I have all this stuff? I don't need all this stuff. Like, I'm used to a camera, some dolly track, and then I was just like, that's just how you make a movie. And so by the time I got there, I was slightly nervous. But once I got into my groove, it was not... Yeah. I kind of, directing is knowing what you want. And then you just, as you do it more and more, what you want in your head and what you end up with are really similar. In the beginning, what you want and what you get are a little bit further apart.
Well, let's talk about that just for a second. So in terms of what your process is, you get a script from a friend or your agent, you read it, you like it. How do you start?
I don't know, any script I've ever gotten was never that close to what you end up with, but you find something you really sink your teeth into. And then a lot of it is then at that point making the story work. There's always like in a movie, there's always like moments that you're like, you need it to happen because that's what makes it a movie to watch. But you're like, that's a really hard turn. It's been important to me to make movies that are emotionally honest, meaning that whatever the character, you have to be with the character and understand why they made a decision. Cause I think when a movie loses you and you're like, they would never do that.
Yeah.
And it's just about being sensitive to human beings and how people react. And then what you do is sometimes you get to a point in the script where you're like, that's a hard turn to make, but maybe there's a way we can make this happen. And I just gotta give the example, like in The Wedding Singer, if you think about it, Robbie and Julia, right? They're like best friends. And the boyfriend's an asshole and he cheats on his girl. So there's a scene where he has to tell Robbie Hart, I cheat on my future wife. That's your best friend. So on the page, I'm thinking, that's not really believable. And then, so we constructed the scene in the writing, and then it's in the direction it follows, which is they're in a club together. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but a hot waitress goes by and
checking her out.
And Robbie Hart, Adam's character, is like, oh shit, he's checking her out in a way that I don't like a guy that's going to marry my friend. And so he baits him in with his ego. And this guy's all ego. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. You used to get girls like that. Not anymore, though. And, you know, he feeds into the guy's ego. And he starts telling him, yeah, I get chicks like that 10 years ago. Try 10 days ago, you know. And it has to be written well. And it has to be directed well. But there's always things like that in a movie that can often lose the audience. And that's the difference, I think, between a movie that sticks around and people like, you know. I feel lucky. My movies are still on TV, and they sort of so I feel like it's because those kind of moments, they're emotionally honest. I feel like they stand the test of time.
Yeah, you took the words out of my mouth. I feel that's so true, and especially with comedy, I feel like it's harder because if you don't know the tone of the comedy world you're in, and you like have a kind of a crazy thing happen that like doesn't fit with the tone of the rest of the movie, it really stands out. And I feel like you doing such a beautiful job of like, however you manage to get everyone on the same page. But what do you do when you have actors? Cause you do have a lot of cameos, including yourself in your movies, but when you work, with actors that have such a well-known persona. So I'm thinking like Christopher Walken and Click, or even Schwarzenegger in Around the World, like, and Jackie Chan on top of that. Like, how do you direct? Like, I need more Christopher Walken here. I need less Christopher Walken here. Like,
well, Walken is like the kind of guy where you get Walken.
Yeah.
You don't cast Walken to do anything but Walken.
Right.
And what you just try to do is he fit Morty. We kind of wrote it with him in mind. He does his thing. He puts his punctuation in odd places, and we knew that would work. And all I try to do is make maybe a little more poignant version of him. And I mean, he's such a great actor. So with him, you kind of know what you get. Jackie was fun because I wanted him to have a little more depth, and he hadn't done stuff like that. And he played a real sweet role with some real dramatic moments. You know, even though it's a light and airy movie, Around the World in 8 Days, there's some real moments of pain when he feels like he deceived Phileas Fogg. And I was like, I was excited to get to have Jackie do stuff that he hadn't really done a whole lot. Like some real emotion stuff. And I thought he did a wonderful, wonderful job. I mean, these people that are pros, they're excited to do something new with you. And so he was amazing to work with. And obviously a genius on the stuff he knows how to do.
How do you collaborate? How did you collaborate with him on the choreography?
He lived down the block at the time, and I went to his house every night, and I sat with him, and we would talk about stuff, and I would just get in his brain. And I didn't want to do a lot of his American movies. The action felt disconnected. It was like, there's the movie, and then here's an action scene. I'm like, I really want to integrate the story into his action. I want the other actors to be a part of the action. So I sat there with him every night and got in his head, and he loves to figure shit out. And he loved that this had a balloon with a rope, and he was a genius and saying, I'm hanging on the rope. I'm like, yeah, exactly. And then he goes, the rope pulls up the building. Okay. And then I'm like, oh, so in each floor we could have a different funny thing you see. And then, so it was just spending the time and I just being close to people and getting comfortable. They're artists. I'm artists. The more you spend time, the more you put the work in, you know, the more you get out of it. And I get these amazingly talented people. So it's just me letting them flourish and do what they do best and making it all fit into the story. I have the big picture.
Right.
So I just got to keep them included in the big picture in the right way.
Do you open up to a lot of improv on the set or try to keep it?
Definitely. It's definitely go in with the plan. And then once you get the plan, then come up with shit. And so much stuff comes up when you're shooting. And, you know, some people love that. Some people are just great. You know, with Sandler, I had a rhythm where, you know, we'd get to the punchline and then keep it right. That's great because I was one of the first people to shoot HD. HD was great because when I used to shoot film, I'd be like, keep it rolling, you know, but it costs a lot more then. And it would be like Sandler, he'd do a bunch of different punchlines. Because you just get in a rhythm and he's making us laugh. And it's just, that's when you come up with funny lines. It's that spontaneous. I mean, comedy is that thing where you can't always place why something's funny. It's just a cadence. It's just the way you say it. And that has to happen sometimes live almost. So, yeah. I mean, it's recorded, but it's live in that you're being spontaneous. Yeah.
Would you say that like directors of comedy need a certain skill set that drama directors maybe don't?
I mean, it's funny. I was a little down that I was doing comedy at first because in America, they're not really thought of as, you know, great art usually. The Brits know it is. And I had a moment where I was in between movies. I think it was after The Waterboy, and I was stoned, I think. And I saw my dog, and my dog, I'm looking at, and I'm like, he could get happy. He can get sad. He can get angry. And I always try to make him laugh. I pop around the corner. Nope, can't ever get him to laugh. I'm like, he definitely doesn't get irony. And so then I was like, well, what animals can laugh? And I was like, chimpanzees, dolphins, and humans. And I was like, all right, I don't feel so bad that I made comedies. I'm like, you actually have to be intelligent.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Because a drama, in a way, and look, they're not intelligent, but it's easier to miss with comedy than it is with drama.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it made me, I had that revelation. I'm like, all right, so you have to actually be smart to make comedy. And that goes back to, you said tone. And tone, to me, is what a director does more than anything. The reason I think Quentin Tarantino is a genius is he created a tone that nobody else had done. It was comedy with violence, you know, and Pulp Fiction, when he turns, you know, he accidentally blows his head off and the brains hit the back. Nobody had done anything like that, really, at that time. And that's why his movies are so, they stand out, and they're really brilliant. And so it's about tone for me, and finding the balance between the pain and then the comedy and the uplifting in the same movie. For me, that's what I hope I'm sort of mastering. But I don't want every movie to be the same, but I do like I'm comfortable in different versions of that,
right?
For sure. That's what I like to push. Some of the films that I love are like that. The World According to Garp is one of my favorite films, mm-hmm. and it really does that.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, actually, I think I know this to be true, because I watched the featurettes on some of your films, and everyone from Christopher Walken to all the actors, Henry Winkler, you normally work with, just say Frank brings such an amazing energy to the set, and he's so open to suggestions, and he has this like childlike energy. And Around the World in 80 Days was a 6-month shoot, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Long. So do you have a secret you can share with us? Like, how do you wake up with all of that stuff you know you've got to do for the day and still lead the ship? So,
well, first of all, it's the greatest job in the world if you want to do it, because you get to dream shit up and you get millions of dollars and amazingly talented people that make what you dream come alive. So there's no better satisfaction than going, hey, I have shit in my head, and 100 million people are going to see what was in my head.
Right.
So that alone is, I feel blessed beyond belief. Like it's so funny. I'm so excited about making The Legend of Sinbad. Like, I almost slipped in the shower one time when I was in a hotel because it was, bathtub. I was like, all right, I got to be really careful. I was like so afraid from this point on. When I get out of the shower, I'm like, I don't want to blow this opportunity to get to direct this movie. If I break my leg and my back.
You have to be the bubble boy until like shooting.
Literally, that's how much I love what they do. But that being said, to go to set to be that happy, I have to be super prepared. So there's nothing in my life I do more work for than be totally prepared. And even if I throw the plan out, to be confident, I have to go in with a great plan. Then I can tell that this new idea is even better than the plan. Mm-hmm. If you don't have the plan, you don't know if a new idea is better than what it could have been. You know what I mean? Sure. So I'm happy to be there, especially when I did all my homework.
Yeah.
And which is almost every, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of like, you know, 6-day weeks and you get a little bit behind. But I love to visualize the whole movie. I read, you were saying before, what I do, I read the script, I get the script to work right with my writers, and then we rehearse it with the actors. They have to feel comfortable. Like, so by the time you shoot, you've read through the lines, everybody has their issues they bring up, you talk through it, you fix it, and then I literally see the whole movie in my head. I think I have a gift of being able to, I can shoot the movie in my head beforehand. That's one of that's the thing I got blessed with. I can edit while I'm shooting. I'm editing. I know where the edit point is. That's the fun part for me. It just takes a lot of time, but I shot less the whole movie. I storyboard it when there's visual effects. But the whole movie's literally planned out. And Kate, like I said, when you're on set, you're like, hey, throw another camera here. But pretty much I have the movie already in my head when we go into it. Like I said, the thing that you learn, what you have in your head and what the movie is, when you first start, when you do your student film, that's why everybody's like, they usually, you do your first short film, that you know, like your big thesis film, and everyone's usually miserable. And it took me a year to edit a 10-minute film because it's not what you wanted exactly. But like I said, you get to the end. But now what I have in my head, and especially if I have qualified people around me, and what the film looks like is very, very similar.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the thing that I'm on my, this is my 11th movie. That's the thing that now I got down. And then honestly, the pain in the ass is all the politics, or the, how do we get this movie star to do it? Or how do we get the financing? Or, you know, it's, that's the stuff that's not fun.
Yeah.
But it's nice that it's just reduced to that now. Cause when you're first starting, the movie's overwhelming and that's overwhelming. And so, yeah, that's why doing a little $3 million film was great. Cause it was just me, the film, the buck stopped at me. And, you know, it was fun. I love to bounce back after I do this big one and do another little one.
Did you start Waterboy before Wedding Singer came out?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So you didn't have to deal with the tidal wave quite yet of what that movie would become while you were working on Waterboy, right?
No, we hadn't. It was funny. We made The Wedding Singer and it was a debate of when it should come out. And I hardly ever get involved in this, but I was like, oh my God, we need to wait to Valentine's Day. Cause I'm like, it's an Adam Sandler film, so, and it's a romantic comedy with Drew Barrymore. I'm like, girls will go. Guys will be psyched on Valentine's Day to go. I'm like, please, please, please. And they listened to me. And because of that, we were shooting The Waterboy. And then it came out halfway through shooting The Waterboy. We flew home for the premiere, and it was such a huge success. The funny thing was, all of a sudden, the stress on The Waterboy, they were like, take your time, shoot yeah. more, do what you got to do, like, you know, they were like, we were kind of follow a hit, so it was a good thing. Was that the question? I forgot the question.
No, that was I was just going to ask you, like, had it come out and it was a big success, that might have changed things for you, obviously.
We were just happy as fuck when we were making The Waterboy, and the studio was like, go extra overtime, you know, like overtime suddenly didn't matter. They felt confident that they were going to make more money than The Weddings or equal amounts. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just made us just feel good. Like, oh, wait, maybe we know what we're doing.
Yeah.
I guess we do.
Waterboy was on so much when I was growing up. It was like every sleepover I went to or kids came to my house, that was the movie we watched. It was always on at the right time. And we quoted that movie right and left. We were just obsessed with it. So I hope you got a lot of good royalty checks and, you know, residuals from that, because it was on all the time. So I just want to know if you had any sort of, I don't know, secret anecdote from that experience that maybe you haven't shared previously, because it just means a lot to me.
I mean,
and my
anecdote,
friends.
We just literally, that was a character we came up with in
college, right?
College, we basically just made each other laugh on that. I think more than any movie, we were just making each other laugh. And we probably the breaks, you know, we were freed up once The Wedding Singer, so we really just had fun. And luckily, Kathy Bates said yes to doing the movie. It was like, we wrote, that was one of the times we wrote it for her, and we would always write it for somebody and they would never say yes.
Yeah.
And then she said yes, and we couldn't believe we got her. And she was so much fun. A fucking pro. Like, you wouldn't believe. Like, the grips was making noise. Like, quiet. Like, everyone would be quiet. But she was just so much fun. The accent, it's funny. The first day we shot the scene in the hospital, and her accent's much more like fried green tomatoes, you know, that more proper. And it actually worked for the scene. And then the more she worked with Adam in the scenes, the more she got kind of a crazier, you know, southern accent. And it worked perfectly, because then in the beginning she sounds fucking crazy like she does. And it's funny, people at the end say, I had people from New Orleans, because I do the cameo at the end. They're like, you nailed that accent. I'm like, I fucking made that shit up. But maybe I did get it through osmosis. But the thing about Kathy Bates, she had as much fun as we did. I remember she said, Frank, can I come to Daly's? And it's like, I was like, Kathy, you're royalty. You can do whatever you want. Yeah, please. I'm honored that you want to come to Daly's because you wanted to see yourself. And it's kind of a thing where, like, you don't always let the actors see themselves. But when someone like Kathy Bates says it, I didn't even hesitate. And she literally laughs so hard at the Daly's. Daly's, as people don't know, is when you're watching the footage from the day, the raw footage. She laughed so hard, she literally ran out the room because she peed herself. So that's how much fun we had. And that the fact that she was that much fun, and Henry Winkler was that much fun, and Firouzah, I mean, we just were having fun making that movie. And it obviously translated. I'm shocked, because for years it was always The Wedding Singer. But over the course of time, so many kids grew up on The Waterboy, that I think actually, I hear more now, The Waterboy,
right?
Especially in the States. When I'm foreign, it's click. But when I'm in the States, it's more people bring up The Waterboy.
Yeah, I think it was just the timing, like my generation. I mean, I'm sure The Wedding Singer was on too, but I actually thought The Wedding Singer was shot in the 80s, you know, for a long time. Right, because you're,
Yeah,
because...
Well, they did our job, sort of.
Right, yeah.
That was a homage to all the 80s movies I saw, the John Landis, of course. You know, like, yeah.
Yeah, we used to quote Medulla Oblongata, what mama doesn't know won't hurt her. When Henry Winkler asked her, what part of the snake am I eating? Well, I believe it's his knee or something.
I'd say that, like, his knee. Snake don't really have parts.
Yeah, I mean, this was nonstop, Frank, so you really did an excellent job.
Glad I could help.
Yeah, and that whole Colonel Sanders guy getting hit in the head, you know, at every opportunity.
That was my noise idea.
Like,
guy getting hit in the head. It's a grown man making a sound like that is what's going to make it funny.
I love it. Was there a particularly challenging experience you remember, and how did you overcome it, like on working on a film maybe?
I mean, like the one you say that, and the first thing that came to mind was working with the freaking animals on Zookeeper. It was just patience. We worked nights. I tried to get all the animal stuff done so Kevin didn't have to worry about it. I'm very actor friendly. I try to like shoot scenes in orders that, you know, like Steve had a big speech in Hot Air, and I thought, let's do everything facing away from him over the shoulder so he can flub the lines, and he'd do the speech over and over the whole day. And then I flipped on my actors. It was him. It was flip, meaning flip the camera the other way the next day. Not that I flipped out. but it was him, Judith Light, and Skylar Astin. And they were so happy that I'm always thinking about, you know, the most important thing is the actors being comfortable and getting the best performance, because you can do everything else right, but if their performances aren't the best... So I do have
you're
a
the
anti
Kubrick.
Yeah, I guess. I hate to say that. I want to be Kubrick.
No, well, from style, but process is a little different.
Yeah.
Have you wanted, or do you have any thoughts about directing TV? Since that's such
I would love to do TV, because I always go, what happened to all the edgy 70s movies? And I'm like, they're cable TV. And, you know, the Brits figured out cable TV first and did the edgy stuff. And now, you know, it's been, 10, 15 years, where maybe more, 20 years since, you know, Sopranos and all that stuff started to become like, this is where it's all going, the edgy, cool stuff. And I love TV because in the same episode, you've already established people. You can go from funny to dark even quicker. You don't have to set the table. The table's been set on a previous episode. So I it's my next thing. I might have a few shows I've developed that I'm super excited to do. And I really... It's funny, you make a movie and then you're in between movies and you make another movie. It's like literally no matter where you are in your career, you're unless in like maybe Scorsese or Spielberg, you're always kind of figuring out how to get your next movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I want a TV show. So when I'm in between movies, I'm like, I'm going to go do my TV show until the next movie's ready to go.
Yeah.
But more than that, I want to do TV because I love the way you can push the envelope. I also went to school with Vince Gilligan, who did Breaking Bad. And when I hear how, like, it was Jesse Pinkman, he was supposed to die the first season.
Right.
And I love the interactive nature of you put it out there and then you write to what is working or what, and to me, that's exciting to do a project where it's always evolving. And it's like, I think, you know, at some point you needed Jesse to be the conscience of the audience, because at some point you lost Walter White. He took us in. And at some point, when he was more into like his making his drugs and didn't care about killing, you couldn't relate to him. Yeah. But that's what made the show fascinating. You had a shift. And so I'm excited to do TV where you do that. The only thing I always find about TV is it's one of those things where while it's going, it's great. Unlike movies can have a great ending. There's never been a great TV. There's no way to end something that's been so great.
Yeah.
So I hope I can do a TV show that has a great ending.
Yeah.
That's good. I'm right back into that.
Yeah. Well, I wish that for you, since that's your desire. What influences, non-filmmaker influences, art, music, writing, has sort of helped develop your tone, do you think?
That's interesting. Basquiat came to mind. I don't know why. There's something childish about him, and there's something really dark and deep. And there's something ethnic too. It's like African too, and I like that his African comes out. And I just grew up in New York City in the East Village when his graffiti was everywhere.
Oh wow!
I just like that it was from the ground up, and you know, it came from the streets and then onto the walls of rich people's houses.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
You know, he kind of music. I just always love things that aren't mainstream. You know, I was always like, you know, punk rock and like new wave, more new wave even, because it was weird. You know, I grew up on the B-52s and Devo. I was like, we had my high school friends that was like, we like dressed like them, or we dressed weird because of them.
Yeah.
We used to go to their concerts and dress up. And then we're like, why do we just dress up for the concerts? Let's just show up in school that way. And then we became this like kind of freaky crowd. And then all the younger kids started dressing like us, and we started a whole trend. And I think I like to break the norms, but not do it. That why I'm saying new wave more than punk rock is that they break the norms just to be more fun.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And not
it wasn't,
nasty.
It wasn't to be angry or mean.
Yeah.
So I would say anything that pushed, you know, the music I listened to from The Cure to all those 80s bands, but still like the bands I listen to, I'm always looking for somebody that's doing something totally different and edgy and just breaking the trend, you know?
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Any sort of last advice you have for filmmakers, young filmmakers,
just
getting in the biz?
Just making movies. You can do it. You got an iPhone. You can edit on your laptop, on your iPhone. Just keep making movies. Make short ones. Make just shoot something, edit it, write it, think about it. You know, write it, dream up whatever you can do, and then go and make your dream come true. Mm-hmm. You can do it. You can do it. And I'm actually surprised because I think, you know, there's always that thing where people would max out their credit cards. The guy did, I can't remember his name, the actor, director, Brothers McMullen. He did it for like whatever, $30,000. And I'm like, there's so many people that can make a feature film now with their friends on an iPhone, and they could put it on YouTube. And I'm shocked that there's not more movies on YouTube. Like, I think I would probably, if I was 20-something, I would probably have done that. Because I used to do that. I would take a video camera out, and I'd make a half-hour film. It was a lot harder to do. I think you just keep shooting stuff and putting it on. You could do a feature film that, you know, if you want to be a movie director, you could be a movie director, and you could just do it on $5,000 probably, or that's even a lot. You could probably do it for less than that. You know, it might take you a year to shoot something with your friends. But why not? Why not try to make it a feature length thing that you shoot on your iPhone?
This has been such a treat. Thank you so much for doing
this.
Thank
you. No problem. It's been great. You're a good interviewer.
Yeah. Thank you. And everyone, check out Sinbad. It's going into production
soon. The Legend
of
Sinbad. Yeah. It'll be out summer 21, yeah.
Cool. Well, we can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
Thank you again.
You got it. Thank you.
Well, that's it, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to like, share, and subscribe. It really does mean a lot to us. Also, be sure to follow our Instagram at Movie Mentors Podcast, as we'll be releasing special bonus content from this interview and behind-the-scenes goodies on there. Music by Gabe Sokoloff. Be well, everybody, and thank you for listening.